This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Well, we are here. Our guest, our sole guest this week, is Dr. Jack August. He is Arizona's premier historian, and we're going to talk about, among other things, and primary theme is really the whole history of Arizona. The history of water is the history of Arizona. Big question. We all know that, go back historically, we got the Indian canals and all that, but we don't have to go back through prehistoric times. Let's talk, you know, the last century or two.
Okay.
How did we get water here? This is the desert. It's arid. There's not a whole lot of natural water. How did we get it here, and what were some of the issues?
Well, when Europeans came across this area, they saw the Gila River system, the Gila River crossing, the state, the Salt River, some of its tributaries, and, of course, the Colorado River. But in order for the civilization that we exist in today to have come to be and survive and thrive, we needed to manipulate the environment, and that is to move water to where people were. Now, obviously, the first towns in Arizona, as we know it today, were Tubac and Tucson, but those were Spanish presidios built for different reasons. But with the emergence of Phoenix and with the American taking over this region after 1850 and then creating Arizona Territory in 1863, you have the emergence of Phoenix. And again, it's right on the edge of the Salt River. People go to water. You need water to live. And that's how at least European and Anglo-American settlement began.
So do we have ditches first or dams first?
We had ditches first. And in fact, the innovative Confederate morphine, or maybe laudanum addict, Jack Swilling, after an unsuccessful attempt at mining in Wickenburg, came down with a handful of ex-miners. And
Where are we now, time-wise? What year?
1866, 1867.
So immediate post-Civil War.
Immediate post-Civil War, and there's Camp McDowell, later Fort McDowell, established for both – for a variety of purposes,
but that, mostly that Indians. That was not originally a casino.
It was not a casino, no. And these guys saw the opportunity to provide foodstuffs and hay and other types of just necessities to that to Camp McDowell in 1867 as the first crop over the winter, and from there it really just. Just grows exponentially.
Cut crop. They're using Indian canals.
They were using Hohokam canals, and then they built. They hit Caliche a little bit down. They moved about 4 miles west and dug another ditch. So by 1868, you have two significant canals, and you have several harvests moving. By 1870, there's maybe 260 people here.
And this is up around Fort McDowell area?
No, this is down by where Second Avenue is in Phoenix.
Okay,
right,
so
right
now we're down into Phoenix.
Yeah, we're Swilling and his people were, yes.
Okay. Fast forward then.
Okay.
What's the next big deal? So they extend the canals. There's actual agriculture in the 1860s in Phoenix. What's next?
But in the 1870s and 80s, you have the development of what were cooperatives, and which a group of people dug canals, harvested crops, and you have the development of that economy. That's the next step. But soon that doesn't work, and you have some speculators, in particular a governor named Frederick Tritel in the mid-1880s, who sees the potential of putting water to the land and maybe, I think it was 100,000 acres of land that they could grow crops on and harvest and create a new agricultural empire. And indeed, that began to happen with the construction of the Arizona Canal between 1884 and 85. And that's I call it corporate water, that you have investors from the East Coast, from San Francisco, and even from Europe investing in water in this area and crops in order to make a profit.
Did they get rights? And water rights are a huge deal here. Who owns the water? I know the Indians have a lot of first claim on a lot of water. Talk about how that. But did these corporate entities get perpetual water rights out of what they did too?
Well, they tried to. They thought they could, but ultimately a couple of decisions made water appurtenant to the land. And so you have the water not being separated from the land as part of it. And so you have a couple of decisions, one in 1892, the other 1910. I don't think we need to go into those. But suffice to say, prior appropriation, first in use, first in right.
Meaning I've been taking it before you've been taking it, so it's mine.
It's exactly. That's well put. That's the way mm-hmm. it is, yeah. And so
It's not that you're further upstream. Uh-huh. It's that I've been taking it since the 1880s. You came along 10 years later. I have first claim.
Yes. One of the big issues with the advent of the Salt River Valley Water Users Association in the late 90s and early 1900s was the people on the south side, the people in Tempe. They were the oldest users. Dwight Hurd, Carl Hayden's family, and others, A.J. Chandler. These guys had first rights, even though other people wanted to claim them. And so having them fit into the concept of giving up their rights for the larger good, i.e. the Salt River Project, or what was in the Salt River Valley Water Users Association in 1903 when we established it, that was a big deal. That was a big push. And Hurd had to be convinced by Secretary of the Interior, Ethan Hitchcock, and some of those people Theodore Roosevelt's administration to do that. So we finally get an agreement. But that was not easy. That was a big lift.
Now, a lot of the Indian tribes, relatively sparsely populated, some of them, have big claims to water rights. How'd that come about?
Well, it has to do with a 1908 Supreme Court decision called Winters versus the United States. It's a 7-page decision. It has to do with a tribe, I think, in North Dakota. And it's very simple, and it's basically said when Congress created these reservations, they also created first rights to water in perpetuity. And that is kind of the water constitution of the United States. So the Native American tribes in Arizona and elsewhere are in a very strong legal position. I don't think any attorneys would argue with me on that point.
So basically, it was the deal. Now live with it.
Yeah. It's a hard one to get around. And so in Arizona, the Gila River tribe and other tribes are big players in the water present and the water future.
Last thing before we go to break. Teddy Roosevelt comes here, dedicates the dam. He made an interesting statement that you quoted.
Oh, I forget which one I quoted, but he said a lot of stuff. He was known as Theodore the Talkative.
One of the two most
important. One of the two most important achievements in my administration, and mind you, he's getting ready to run again as a Bull Moose, party candidate, mm-hmm. a progressive Republican, is the Roosevelt Dam and the Panama Canal. Those were his two biggest achievements.
That's heady company.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking all things water here on the Think Tank. Now, when we come back, it's Arizona. Arizona got into a gunfight over water. That's right. Arizona got into a gunfight over water. We're going to tell you with whom next.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are back with Jack August, historian, talking about the history of water in Arizona, which is the history of Arizona. And we teased you before we left.
Yes.
We said this actually got to the point of shooting war.
Yeah, it sure did. In the context of Arizona and California wrangling over the rights to Colorado River water one could even say a century just about, it's still ongoing. In the early 1930s, Arizona elected a pediatrician as its governor. His name was Dr. B.B. Moore, and he was an irascible guy and also very much a states' rights Democrat. And Arizona has had, say before Barry Goldwater's breakthrough in 1952, we had two-year terms and one states' rights Democrat after another. Was elected.
And people forget, we were a solid Democratic state until Barry Goldwater upset that alpa cart.
That's exactly right. And there's a kind of a blending between 52 and, say, even up to 80 with registration. But by then, by Barry, it was a sign that we were moving to the right as a state. But back to Moore, Arizona's political life was, again, centered around water in the 20s with George Hunt. But he passes away in 1932. Moore takes the mantle, and By that time, California is moving forward under the auspices of the Colorado River Compact, and Congress agrees to Parker Dam.
What is the California River Compact?
It's Colorado River Compact. We can go back in 19...
Between whom and whom?
Okay, it's the seven states that are the Colorado River, the Upper Basin, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico for the most part, Colorado, and the Lower Basin states are Arizona, Nevada, and California. And you know, our issues are in the Lower Basin, so we kind of divided the river in half. And so by this time, 10 years after the fact, 1932-33, Congress allows Parker Dam to be constructed, another kind of maybe a cash register dam, as it were, and a regulatory dam. And so they start building it, and Moore says, no, that's on Arizona territory and states' rights, and you're violating our states' rights. And so he sends up the National Guard. Well, indeed, they get up there. And we send up a couple of a Navy, two ships.
The Arizona Navy.
And, there's a couple of shots fired and lots of histrionics. But ultimately what happened is he sends them up in the middle of the summer. These guys are dying of thirst. And the California opposition, i.e. the construction workers on the dam, go over and save, for the most part, the Arizona National Guard, which is like, God, we need some water. We need some help. They kind of got stuck over. That's rough territory, if you know.
It's the sounds like the bullhead. Beginning of California socialism.
It sure does, doesn't it? So anyway, we had the little war with California. It did nothing for Arizona's cause, really. It made us look foolish, and we were the one state out of the seven states that did not sign the Colorado River Compact, which was crafted in 1922, signed by Herbert Hoover, was the head of it. He was then Secretary of Commerce in the Harding and Coolidge administrations. He was the overseer. He was a Californian, by the way. So we thought we divided the river. That was the law of the river. It was far from it. It was vague, and the Indians weren't even treated in it. There was an article that said nothing in this compact has to do with Indians. That does nothing. And so from that point forward, there's all types of litigation. Arizona files four Supreme Court cases in the 30s to no avail.
And one of these is interestingly named Arizona v. California.
Yes, and that finally gains traction after the war. And with the rise of—
And the war you're talking about is World War II.
World War II. Congress is looking to put guys to work after the war, and so public works projects. Carl Hayden is in the post-war planning committee. Senator Hayden, who's gaining more and more seniority and ultimately becomes head of the Appropriations Committee. And you have to also remember that he's born in 1877 on the south side of the Salt River, grew up with the great floods of the 1860s, one in 70, the big one in 1891, the giant one in 1905, which created the Salton Sea and really led to the construction of Hoover Dam as a flood control dam.
So born in Monty's restaurant before Monty was there.
Yeah, he didn't even serve any steaks. He got out of there before that.
And if you haven't been to it, it's a great place to just walk around and take the tour.
Yeah.
Because they got pictures and they got the real stuff there.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. It's a great legacy of the Hayden family here. But by 52, the contentious issues between Arizona and California are too much to handle. California has the large House of Representative delegation, so no bill to build a CAP project, which is formulated during the war. The Parker Plump Plan, we can maybe divert the water from that point where it is now to Central Arizona into Tucson. And finally, we get the court case. And it looks like in 52, we start, and it's 4 years of briefings, and it's a tough road for Arizona. And in fact, our sitting governor then, and we talked about this earlier, Governor Ernest McFarland, who had been defeated by Senator Goldwater, McFarland goes and argues one of the motions in 54 and wins it. A sitting governor goes and argues before the Supreme Court and wins the motion. I think that's the only time in history that's happened.
That a sitting governor argued his own case.
Argued the case for Arizona,
but
yes.
But as you pointed out, he was actually a water lawyer.
He was a water lawyer, a good one. He was from Florence and all that's ag land, which is still there. That's part of his legacy. He was Pinal, a county attorney, before he became a U.S. senator. And then didn't come home. Kind of what happened to Cantor in this recent election, kind of it seemed to have happened to McFarland. He didn't go home enough.
Yeah, and a tidbit, if we're tying this all in together with more recent history, the family ended up owning Channel 3.
Absolutely.
No longer, but for quite a number of years.
Yeah, he early on saw the future of telecommunications and television. So, so anyway, we're in this case from 1952 until 63, the longest Supreme Court case in American history. And for the most part, I think the way it shook out, Arizona won, but with some issues that were still that Congress had to take on after the case is rendered in 1963 and affirmed in 64.
What'd we win? We win the right to take out a certain amount of water.
Yes, yeah. That California was taking over 5 million acre feet. That was too much. And there was a formula that was formed in debates in Congress in 1928 with the passage of what was then the Boulder Canyon Project Act. And the formula was pretty much formed there. And I remember that it was December 12, 1928, an exchange between Senator Hayden and Senator Bratton from New Mexico, and the formula of 2.8 million acre feet, including the Gila, all of the Gila for Arizona, 4.4 for California, and you're not supposed to go above that, and 0.3 for Nevada. Nevada was the weak sister on all these.
So we get 2.8, they get 4.4?
Yes, that was the original formula.
Now, what happens if the water flows low? Who gets first?
Well, that deals with the legislation. And passed in 1968, and Arizona is the first to give up its water.
All right, so obviously water, and we're talking water today because it's Arizona's most precious resource. But I want to ask you, in this world of water, who is the very most important Arizonan? I want your answer right after the break.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here with historian Jack August, and the lead-in we promised to talk about, who is the most important Arab? We're going to make that the theme of this segment, some of the key people that have been involved in these issues in the state's history, and really a lot of that relates to water. You can lead, or you don't have to give the answer, but by the end of this segment, your take on who is the most important Arizona.
Okay. Well, let's start there and maybe wrap it up, double back on it. Carl Hayden, let me personalize a little bit. When I was a little kid, I grew up here, and I asked my parents, I said, why are you voting for that guy? He looks so old, and you know, he doesn't look like he can do anything. And they said, has to do with water. And I was like a little, I just didn't understand. I saw this image on TV, and it was Carl Hayden.
You know, I remember that same image. I'm a teenager. Lyndon Johnson's giving the State of the Union address, and behind him are these two ancient old duffers.
Yes.
One of them is Carl Hayden, and the other is McCormick from Massachusetts. And they both looked like 100 years old.
Yeah, and it was close. But going back, Carl Hayden was Maricopa County Sheriff from 1907 to 12. Was about to play in the first Rose Bowl game as a center at Stanford University in 1900. Michigan beat Stanford 51-0.
We could argue about what the first Rose Bowl game was.
Okay. And Hayden, when he was at Stanford, wrote his parents and said, look, I'm not going to – his dad's saying, let's take over the mill. And he goes, the floods, the droughts, John Y.T. up the street, John Y.T. Smith, I was born to be to make water law. I was that's where the power is, and I'm going to run for office. So he runs for Tempe Council, county treasurer, sheriff of Maricopa County. He arrests the last train robbery suspects in 1910 in an automobile instead of horses. And then he goes on and begins really with the Coolidge Dam and helping facilitate the great infrastructure, not just the CAP, but many other important water structures and delivery systems in the American West. I would say that in many ways that little old guy was a vigorous young man and had his almost a singular focus on water conservation, storage, irrigation, and the development of hydroelectric power and highways. He was big into highways too. He wasn't just a one-trick pony.
And the mind-boggling factoid is, having watched him in 1969, was that he was a congressman from statehood on.
Yes, he was. He was our first special election of 1911. He wins. It was a bit of an upset, but and then he goes on and does a fantastic job. Didn't care if people were Republicans or Democrats. He helped everybody, got along with everybody. Known as the silent senator, he did all his work behind the scenes, very rarely gave a speech on the floor. He's kind of Arizona's legislative water master. He's important. McFarland, also a water attorney, talked kind of slow and funny like that, from Oklahoma, but he finished Stanford Law School in 2 years and also had his eye on the water prize.
And talk about legislative leaders getting beat. He was the majority leader of the United States Senate, got beat by this upstart by the name of Lyndon Johnson.
No, Barry Goldwater. Oh, yeah, Barry Goldwater beat him here in Arizona.
Goldwater beat – that's right. Goldwater beat him, and then Lyndon Johnson takes over the position.
Yes, he does. Yeah. And he shouldn't probably have lost, and he wanted to get that back. He ran twice
bitter,
more.
Bitter.
Very. They still, it's still not a good thing for either side there. But he made the call. We had a guy arguing the case in 52, John P. Frank. It's part of the record. It's part of my book, Dividing Western Waters, about this case. They said, you know, this is going in the wrong direction. They're arguing a legal theory that's not going to work. And so basically they let him go and they placed Mark Wilmer, who many people agreed at the time in the 1950s, by 1957, the greatest, best litigator in the state. So he's another guy that should be up there in discussions with Hayden about our water. He changed the legal theory, threw out, much to the astonishment of the California legal team, he threw out the previous theory and offered a new theory. And the special master, Simon Rifkind, said, okay, you can do it. California was stunned. And from 57 to 63 to the end of the case, Arizona was like a locomotive running down the track. Arizona's legal theories won. And Mark Wilmer is another one that should be in that discussion as major players in shaping the history and also the future of Arizona water. I also would like to say something about recently retired Senator Kyle, who's an outstanding water attorney and really demonstrated great statesmanship with these Indian water rights settlements, which are crucial.
And a very quick guy. I remember years ago I met him,
uh-huh.
And he said that he was an attorney for SRP, and I asked him, are you a in-house counsel? He said, no, more like outhouse counsel.
That's very good.
I thought that was very quick.
That's very good, yes. And he's still, and to his credit, he's still exhibiting kind of statesmanship and leadership. Guys like out at ASU, there's a water kind of institute being developed along with Grady Gamage and some of the other major players in the water world, as it were. And it's a handful, but it's growing, and I think that's good. Also, Arizona does water pretty well. And I'd like to say we have people that outside of the elected officials, Central Arizona Water Conservation District, the people at SRP deserve mention, and several others that are innovators. We have water banking. We have all types of great conservation measures, wastewater usage. We have some decisions to make for the future, like are we going to have swimming pools?
Well, big question I want to ask about. This is the big one that we get to. Do we have enough water, and how bad could it get?
Well, here's my way of explaining it. That's exactly like my asking you, quote, do you have enough money? And the answer would be, it all depends. How do you want to live? How risk-averse are you? What do you have in savings? And how many generations are you trying to protect? I think water, like many big public policy issues, is a generational. You got to think in time.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I've been, you know, if you've been reading the newspapers in Tucson, Phoenix, LA, we may be facing shortages called by the Department of Interior, the big kahuna in all of this, in 2 years, maybe as early as 2016.
Let me define that a little bit. I say if we have to give up our lawns, you know, life isn't going to change that much.
Yeah, look at Tucson.
But we're going to have to shower. We're going to have to, whatever agriculture we have, we're going to have to feed that. We're going to have to live a normal, and Tucson uses a lot less water.
Yes.
But do we have enough? If we give up the lawns and we do reasonable conservation, we have enough to fundamentally sustain ourselves.
Yes, it's unrealistic to think that someday up in, I live in Prescott, I don't think I'm going to turn on the faucet and no water will come out. It's not going to be like that, but I think some of the structural deficits and the drought for 15 years has played a major role. In 2000, Lake Mead, for example, was at 91% capacity. 2013 or 14, I think it was the 14 figures, it's at 45%. If it goes below 1,000 feet, then some of these triggers take effect, and big agriculture in Arizona will have to deal with it. But I don't think in Phoenix or Tucson or any of the other metropolitan or megapolitan areas you're going to see anything in the short run. In the long run, we do have to do some things.
But I think what I hear you say is we're going to have to make some adjustments. Yes. We're not going to have to pack up and leave.
Yeah.
Is that
exactly right?
Well, that's comforting.
Yes. So what's the indicator? What do we look for as the citizenry? What do we look at and say, okay, now we're getting in trouble? Instead of reading water tables, what do we see? Is it the lakes that we look at? What do we look at?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the general public could look at is watch Lake Mead's levels.
Okay.
If it goes below 1,000 feet, I think it's at about 1,081 feet. If that goes, that triggers, that has to do with hydroelectric power to three states, water supplies. Central Arizona Project will be the first to take hits. The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California will be the last to take a big hit on that. But we're going to have to start conserving and perhaps even paying a little bit more for our water, a more realistic price. So all types of things could happen. But, look at Lake Mead, and every once in a while you'll see something in the paper.
I'm telling you, I'm paying realistic rates. I got to tell you that much right now. All right, Doc and I tie a big bow. Can you tie a bow around water? We're going to give it a try next right here on the Think Tank. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with historian Jack August, and we're talking about water in the history of Arizona. Though, and I do have to take issue. If we're going to call it modern era Rose Bowl, we have to do continuous. And that would be the original modern era Rose Bowl. I was always taught, at least according to the poster in my office, is Brown University against the then State College of Washington. I think it was 1912.
Right on. Okay, I'll defer. I'm not going to go against the Brownie
here.
Yeah,
I'll separate you two. Do not make me pull this show over.
We don't count some standalone game that wasn't repeated again for another 10 years. We go modern era only here.
Check you out, Doc.
But I do have one concluding comment before I know Mike wants to have at me. But the big one, this, we think of this. We've got this feeling in Arizona. We're rugged individualists. We stand on our own. How does that square with the history of water in Arizona?
Well, it doesn't square at all. In fact, had it not been for what I think modern-day conservatives would call large federal spending policies and developing Arizona's infrastructure, like its water infrastructure, its brave new water world, and its transportation infrastructure, the federal highway system, under really promoted in the late 20s, starts getting federalized with a couple of acts, but certainly by the time Eisenhower's president and due to some of his wartime activities, he said, we need to tie this together. Had it not been for those big federal spending policies.
These are massive kinds of things.
Yeah,
these aren't little programs. We're digging ditches across the state.
Yeah, it's very unsexy stuff. But had we not done this, had we not had the Salt River Project, had we not had the Central Arizona Project, all of these, through the Indian Affairs budget, Carl Hayde was able to get Coolidge Dam built. He had to find another way to get that on track. And Coolidge was going to ultimately, for example, in the 1920s, President Coolidge was going to veto that bill. Carl Hayden rode to the White House and said, Cal, look, we're going to name this after you. And so he just kind of, okay, and did it and signed it. He was even at the dedication, by the way. Had we not had those kinds of actions and innovative leaders who saw that the wisdom of our tax money coming back to the state to help develop it.
We would have had the population of Wyoming and be a way state between New Mexico and California.
Yeah, we'd be a pass-through place or a flyover place. Mm-hmm. And so we do owe a lot, and I know it kind of grinds at this point, I guess in time, the majority of the voters in our state, but I don't know, maybe be switching a little bit, maybe modulating or moderating. But it was a different world back then. People had a different view of the federal government, you know, and it really is rooted in what historians call the era of progressive reform, the period from 1890 to 1920, when we could we viewed government as a, it could actually fix things. It could help.
And we were progressive. We had a constitution that was so progressive that the president said, "I'm not going to admit you to the union until you clean you clean that stuff up."
Yeah, William Howard Taft. You know, Taft. Hayden starts under Taft and ends under Nixon. The world had changed a lot. But we were too radical. Had to get the recall of judges out of the Constitution.
And then we put it right back in.
And,
you can't tell us what to do. That maybe is the enduring feature of Arizona character. You can't tell us what to do.
Yes.
Now, help me out with this. I can't stop it from playing in my head. You said a reasonable rate for water. Now, what you were proposing is that we need to put more money into this, or is it a issue of the more we charge, the less people will use?
I think it's the latter. I think if water rates rise, it will encourage conservation, and I think all the studies that I've read, institutional reports and human behavior, that's going to be one of the ways that we can facilitate conservation of water. We got to take some conservation measures. That's certainly one of many tools in the toolkit.
I'm just not hearing any of it. I'm not hearing a lot of, even being it here in the newsroom, I'm not hearing a lot of, we have a water problem. I hear we don't have a lot of rainfall. I hear we don't have a lot of rainfall. I'm not hearing our resources have been depleted or are depleting rapidly. Why is this not getting more press if this is our number one resource?
I think we're right on at the beginning of it. There was a big article on the June 15th Arizona Daily Star, very well done. I recommend anyone take a look at it, about the drought. We're in the middle of a 15-year drought. Who knows how long it's going to last, but the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation is now taking action. People are the machinations are taking place to take a look at how we're going to handle these shortages as early as 2016. I don't want to be, you better watch out, and here we better move to the Midwest. But I think maybe right now, the fact that we're having this discussion today is certainly a sign that the discussion is beginning.
Hard to get people though really worked up about something, because you still turn on the tap, the water's there, and it's dirt cheap.
Yeah.
I had a discussion with the head of the water department in Phoenix once. He says, here's my problem. He said, for a penny gallon, I can deliver magnificent water. But what I have to do is deliver water so cheap that you can dump it on the lawn. But when people ask about the quality, they measure it by the water that's in the glass that they drink.
And Mike, you know what? I just on the way over to the studio today, I was listening to the radio. What did the Phoenix City Council do last night? They're going to raise parking rates downtown to maybe $4 an hour, and they're going to raise water rates. And that was the big news. I didn't hear the specifics because then I just pulled in.
I think
they
were looking for money, not water conservation.
Yeah,
they're in a tight squeeze.
Yeah, now they were. And all I heard in those of the two that you mentioned, all I've heard was parking meter. I haven't heard the water rates. Why is that? Is it political suicide? What is this?
No, I think they just took a realistic look at it. The new head of the water department is Catherine Sorensen, formerly of the Mesa Water Department, and she's no nonsense, visionary, and evidently convincing.
Well, it's easy to be convincing because they just went through a thing that $32 million short. We can either not give employees raises, we can close a lot of senior centers,
right.
Or we can lay off employees. None of those are happy outcomes. The water department chief comes in and says, well, maybe we can have some water conservation. We raise our rates a little bit. It seems to me it's really timely to be able to pull that one off.
Well, that came down to it. I remember in the last mayoral race, I remember water water rates were very, very big deal. It was a very, very big deal in Phoenix. And what they were saying, both of them agreed to a point in Phoenix, at least, that it would hurt economic growth, raising water rates for businesses moving to Phoenix. So have we just put that out? Was that a bunch of electoral grandstanding or what?
I really don't know. You know, it's news to me, and I need to do further research about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you caught me. I mean, as I pulled in here, I heard the news about water rates.
Yeah, I got to look into the water rates too. Yeah, absolutely.
So I got to take a look at. I got to dig down a little bit.
I'm paying enough. Doggone it.
I
want my pool, and I will have it.
I suspect that depends an awful lot on what kind of businesses you're talking about.
Sure,
if you're
talking about
professional offices, nobody cares.
Well, yeah. But
some of the high-tech manufacturing is water-intensive,
absolutely.
And they're going to care.
Right. And our agriculture, our farming.
Absolutely.
Talk about cattle. Good grief.
It's
big, and it's a big deal. And I don't think a lot of people pay attention to it. I don't think a lot of people realize. I know. Well, it's hard. When you go down, we're going to Scottsdale, you see all these resorts and golf courses and stuff. We're swimming in water. We got more water than we know what to do with.
And they'll tell you that's an essential expenditure.
Oh, yes.
and you know what? For them, it is.
Oh, absolutely. Well, for everyone,
you've got to keep that golf course green if you want to attract out-of-town golfers.
And I have to keep my lawn in the back because I want to play catch with the kids. It's your own priorities, and it seems that water is probably a top priority to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the other stuff of water, like the grass, the lawns, and all that stuff like that. Not bathing and drinking, obviously.
Fountains,
we know that.
Aesthetics, lakes in the middle of developments. Yeah, that's all on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to give you a chance, Jack. Is there a website or a resource place where people can go and find any of your work?
Well, just go to Amazon.com. My name is Jack L. August Jr. I think there's maybe 10 books from university presses, mostly on Western water issues, but a biography also of Raul Castro, Dennis DeConcini.
Who was a guest here?
Name
dropper.
A couple of others, the Herberger Theater, a little cultural and urban history. So, but for the most part, I'm involved in natural resource development and water, the history of water use.
And very Arizona-centric.
Very Arizona-centric, but, I go beyond the borders.
All right. Well, we want to thank our guest, Jack August. Thank you so much, Doctor. We appreciate you being here. On behalf of Dr. Mike O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. Thanks for spending some time with us right here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3. KTAR.
Thank you.